Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Turbat Haydariye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Ukraine's president says Russian missile strikes have left millions of households without power in the country. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. And Iran beat Wales 2-0 to keep their World Cup campaign alive, prompting celebrations across the country. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story this hour, the Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts amid Russia's missile onslaught. Volodymyr Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital, Kiev, and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv, and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and a further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate. But Kiev says attacks on infrastructure are intended to harm civilians, that makes them a war crime. Johnny Miller, our correspondent in Donetsk, is with us right now. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. So can you please tell us more about the extent of the power cuts in Ukraine?
Well, they're reaching chaotic levels now, the situation for Ukrainian people. Power out in large parts of the country, huge problems with water. The situation is critical, according to Ukrainian officials. And as you say, this may well cause another major refugee crisis into Western Europe. Russia trying to bring Ukraine to its knees, trying to bring it to the negotiating table by making it impossible for the Ukrainian government to provide even the most basic necessities to their people. And it could cause significant loss of life, particularly if it starts affecting hospitals. Now, will Ukraine be able to sustain these attacks on the energy infrastructure? The president's wife recently went on television saying that Ukrainians are willing and able to live without water and electricity for 2 to 3 years. She cited a survey which said 90% of respondents said so. Now, there is no doubt that there is a huge hatred now of Russia within Ukrainian society, a huge determination to win this war whatever that means, at all costs. It's also important to recognize that Ukraine has become an intensely repressive state. It's banned all independent media. It's banned most political parties. It has a very large and active intelligence agency, the SBU. It has far-right extremist military battalions that round up government critics, particularly pro-Russian critics, and that often kills them. That's been well reported even by mainstream press now. So a combination of that kind of determination, genuine determination by Ukrainian people, and an intensely repressive state means that Ukraine may well be able to sustain these attacks on its infrastructure, which means many people in Russia are suggesting that these attacks on the energy infrastructure aren't going to be enough to bring Ukraine to its knees and bring it to the negotiating table. And they feel that there is going to have to be another major victory by Russia on the battlefields. At the moment, I've seen some videos of Ukraine preparing defenses around Kiev. We don't know if there is a major offensive, where that will be, from Belarus, Donbass, the south. But it looks like Ukraine, people are suffering extremely at the moment. It looks like the attacks on energy infrastructure may well not be enough to bring Ukraine to the negotiating table.
Right. And just on that point, Moscow, as you said, says that it seeks to basically bring Ukraine to the negotiating table. However, Kiev sees things a little bit differently. Kiev says that these attacks are meant to harm civilians and thus should be considered as a war crime. Can you please tell us more about the conflict here?
Well, they have a very good point. It's difficult. There's many experts who are confused why Russia didn't start hitting the energy infrastructure at the beginning stages of the war. It's a military tactic to damage the civilian infrastructure. That infrastructure also has an impact on the battlefield. But Russia's waited a long time to do this. It's doing it now. Ukraine has a very good point. This will damage the lives of civilians. It may well lead to loss of life if it starts hitting hospitals. It's also important to recognize that here in Donetsk, Ukraine is doing exactly the same thing. There's no running water in my apartment. There's some problems with electricity sometimes. Whenever I've nothing planned, I simply follow the incoming from Ukrainian shelling, and it's usually at schools, hospitals, and often on water and electricity supplies. So Ukraine is trying to do exactly the same thing here in Donetsk. It's just that Russia has far greater firepower and has been far more effective in their tactic. So both sides are trying to destroy the civilian infrastructure here in Donetsk and in Kiev.
Thank you so much, Johnny, for joining us. Johnny Miller, correspondent in Donetsk. Have a good day.
Moving on,
NATO's chief says it's up to Germany to decide if it wants to supply Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems to Ukraine following a request by Poland.
We have also provided significant air defense systems to Ukraine, including with modern systems. Germany has provided modern air defense systems to Ukraine. And I will, at the foreign ministerial meeting next week, urge allies to further step up the support, not least with air defense, to Ukraine. But specific decisions on specific capabilities, that remains national decisions.
Stoltenberg was referring to talks between NATO members, Germany and Poland, over the Patriot air defense system. Berlin offered to deploy the U.S.-made system in Poland after a stray missile hit a Polish village near Ukraine's border last week, but Warsaw told Germany to ship the system to Ukraine instead to help it fight against Russia. On Thursday, German officials said the Patriot units were intended for use in NATO territory. Berlin further insisted that any use of the weapons outside of this area would need prior discussions with NATO allies. Germany has already cautioned that NATO should not become a participant in the Ukraine conflict with Russia while trying to strengthen Kiev's defenses. Political commentator Digby James Wren says Germany doesn't want to be seen actively supporting the continuation of the conflict in Ukraine. Have a listen.
Germany is on the side generally that they're looking for negotiations, and those negotiations need to be between Russia and the US, not Russia and Ukraine. And the second thing is that they're also trying to shift the responsibility to NATO per se directly, or even to the US. Germany doesn't want to be seen to be fueling more fighting. Germany is in effect trying to push the responsibility to NATO and therefore to Washington. It doesn't want to be seen as actively supporting continuation of conflict on the ground in Ukraine. And I think that Scholz is, you know, in his recent meetings in China and with the G20 and so forth, they definitely want to go towards a negotiated peace. And the only way this can happen is if Washington speaks directly with Russia. And I think the Germans are trying to push that responsibility publicly to Washington and to try and catalyze negotiations.
Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this goal, which has repeatedly been decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated to the Syrian opposition said Turkey carried out new raids on the northeastern province of Hasakah earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it intensified the strikes since last week when an explosion in Istanbul killed six people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria. They have denied the allegation. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syria's sovereignty. Independent political analyst Mohammed Hassan Dabla says Turkey's attacks on Syria are a serious threat to peace and stability in the region.
This is really a serious concern for the region in terms of peace and stability. As you know, the ethnic spillover, the effect of this war will have the consequences could not be imagined. It could lead to an all-out war. It could even involve Iran to take actions in support of the Syrians. They are taking advantage at the moment of the current situation where Russia, that had a lot of influence over in Syria, is at the moment involved in the Ukraine war, and Turkey is taking advantage of that, trying to expand its influence in the northern northern Syrian areas.
Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope. Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nurses in Britain are planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase have been turned down by the government. The strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union would be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales, and Northern Ireland will be walking out on December 15th and 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that would help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to the demands of healthcare workers.
What the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the Health Secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged the difficult situation that healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of the unprecedented inflation. He stressed that his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. The planned strikes by the nurses will be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors. They're struggling to get by as the UK grapples with a 40-year high inflation rate of 11.1%.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. Lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family. You never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reasons. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purizat, London.
Iran have defeated Wales 2-0 in the Qatar World Cup to keep alive its hopes of advancing to the knockout round. Ruzbeh Chashmi and Ramin Rezaian scored both of Iran's goals in injury time to send the fans into ecstasy. Iran now have 3 points in Group B of the games and will face the U.S. in a make-or-break decider on Tuesday. The victory prompted jubilant scenes and celebrations across Iran. In a congratulatory message, President Ebrahim Raisi thanked the national team and vowed to continue to support them. With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Thank you for your company.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Basij, manifestation of self-sacrifice and martyrdom. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Basij week. Basij Week reminds us of volunteer forces who selflessly devoted themselves to the lofty ideals of the Islamic Revolution and in full obedience to Imam Khomeini cast fear in the hearts of enemies and ill-wishers, as if the Basij forces have signed their holy covenant with their blood since they never step back till their last breath. Great martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani had said, "The condition for martyrdom is to be a martyr. No one can become a scholar before acquiring knowledge." He meant that unless one lives like a martyr, he would never deserve to be killed in the way of God. By the way, how can one live the life of a martyr? Let us first understand the meaning of martyrdom in Islam. In Islam, a martyr is specifically a person who starts fighting the enemies and is killed in the way of God. But it has a broader meaning, as the Quran says that those who have faith in God and His Apostle, they are indeed the truthful and martyrs with their Lord. A hadith from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, reads, "When a seeker of knowledge dies while acquiring it, he passes away a martyr." The Prophet also says, "He who dies with the love of my progeny will die a martyr." According to the Islamic culture, those who march in the path of truth and die while fulfilling their duties, they die as martyrs, just as reaching the summit of a mountain requires to pass the slopes. Achieving martyrdom requires passing through the lower steps. This is what Martyr Soleimani meant. The first phase of servitude of God is to know that everything is from Him, even our soul. A martyr only thinks of fulfilling his duty and pleasing God. Thus, he will never think of richness or poverty. Neither will he be worried about victory or defeat. Of course, martyrdom is a stage of wise life. The Noble Quran makes it clear in Surah Al-Imran that martyrs are not dead, but they are living and provided for near the Lord. Defending the oppressed is one of the most important divine duties. Imam Ali, peace upon him, said his children in the last moments of his life, "Be the enemy of oppressors and helper of the oppressed." The Imam has not limited his word to a specific religion. Defending the oppressed is the core of a struggle in the way of God. Martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari says, "War with the aim of employing economic or human forces of a nation is by no means acceptable in Islam. In view of Islam, such wars are a kind of oppression. Jihad can only be legitimate as defense and, in fact, a struggle against aggression. Today, war has found broader dimensions. As for the cultural, economic, or political wars, it is not the geographical borders that are invaded. It is rather the divine borders and the borders of humanity, freedom, and justice that are violated. It is very hard to live a martyr in such soundless wars, as it is too difficult to distinguish an oppressor from an oppressed. A martyr is the one who does not lose the right way, as he has an indicator and guide, that is, the leader and imam who is divinely helped." The Noble Quran says, "O you who have faith, obey Allah and obey the Apostle and those vested with authority among you. He who is the servant of God can be a true Basiji and a living martyr. A Basiji is a person who gives whatever he has, but he never disobeys the leader. The best role model for Basiji were the 72 companions of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who sacrificed their life in the way of the Imam without thinking of the enemy. They never left their Imam alone. Their absolute obedience of the Imam keeps reverberating in the world for those who seek freedom and humanity. They tell us that the Islamic Ummah will not be monolithic and firm without the Imam. True Basiji forces are the flag bearers of vigilance. They keep awakening dormant souls in the world to stage uprising against oppressors. The Iranian Basiji, the Hezbollah of Lebanon, the Hashd al-Sha'bi of Iraq, the Palestinian Hamas, and other forces in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere are the members of the faithful Ummah. They will never tolerate the U.S. hegemony in the world. They have indeed turned into the nightmare to shatter the dreams of the global arrogance and Zionism." We'll be right back.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Designing the bomb.
Part 2.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. Managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics. The third god was a creator god, or Brahma, similar to Jewish creation myths. But in front of him were gods with destructive forces. Scientists bet on the Trinity test. Some predicted that the bomb would not work. Some predicted its strength up to 45 tons of TNT.
Yeah.
In the first days of August 1945, the United States announced the names of several cities as targets of airstrikes by spreading leaflets over Japanese cities. The Japanese people thought that they were just bombings of conventional weapons, and news of the invention of the nuclear bomb had not yet spread. The United States did not mention Hiroshima among the cities it warned, while Hiroshima was the first target of the Americans for nuclear bombing. The Americans chose the bomb, the little boy, for Hiroshima. On August 6, 1945, B-26 bomber took off from Northfield and flew 6 hours to Japan. B-26 bomber carried the little boy to drop it on Hiroshima. Japanese radars detected American planes an hour before the bombing. A red status report was immediately sent to the radio. Around 8 a.m., the radar operator announced that, surprisingly, there were only 3 enemy aircraft approaching the area. At that time, Japan had a shortage of fuel and aircraft, and usually did not intercept small air formations. The Hiroshima anti-aircraft fire teams received the warning, but all the involved parties during the war were ordered not to shoot at a small number of enemy aircrafts, especially over big cities. By this order, they wanted to prevent conflicts over densely populated cities and decrease the number of civilian casualties. Based on this, and thinking that 3 American aircraft with conventional weapons were nearby, a regular warning was broadcast over the radio, asking people to immediately go to shelters if they saw American B-29 Super Fortresses. At 8:09 a.m., Colonel Paul Tibbetts, the operation commander and aircraft captain of the B-29, started the operation by preparing to launch the bomb. 6 minutes later, the bomb was ready to be dropped over Hiroshima. At 8:15 a.m., Little Boy atomic bomb was dropped over Hiroshima. The little boy, with 64 kilograms of uranium-235, took about 43 seconds to reach the height of 600 meters above the city from an altitude of 9,470 meters. Atomic bomb exploded 600 meters above Hiroshima. After dropping the bomb, the bomber quickly moved away from Hiroshima's sky and flew 18.5 kilometers away from the explosion site. The bomb was supposed to hit the Aoi Bridge, but due to the wind, it exploded 240 meters away and exactly on Shima Hospital. A few moments later, the operator of Radio Tokyo realized that the communication line with Hiroshima was completely cut. He tried to contact Hiroshima on another phone line, but it was unsuccessful. The situation was reported to the capital authorities, and 20 minutes later, the Tokyo Central Telegraph Office found out the country's main telegraph line had been cut from north of Hiroshima onwards. A train station situated 16 kilometers from Hiroshima sent unofficial reports of seeing a scary an unnatural explosion in Hiroshima. All reports were forwarded to the Imperial Japanese Army General Staff Office. The military also tried to contact units based in Hiroshima, but they tried in vain. There was no way to contact Hiroshima. Everyone was confused. The military experts knew there was no major air attack on Hiroshima, and there were no large ammunition depots kept in to cause great damage. So why did this city fall into silence all of a sudden? Why was there no response from Hiroshima? A young Japanese officer was ordered to fly to Hiroshima immediately and report on the situation to the capital. The high-ranking commanders believed that the official reports of seeing a terrible explosion were just rumors, and logically, there was no reason for that kind of blast. The young officer went to the southwest of the country, and after about 3 hours of flight, he saw a thick cloud of smoke instead of the city. In the evening light of that day, a view of a ruined city gradually emerged. The pilot and the young officer flew a few laps around the sky of Hiroshima, but they didn't know what had happened. A large rift in the city was still burning, covered in thick smoke. The reconnaissance aircraft landed in the south of the city. The temperature in the area was very high. About 70% of the city was completely destroyed, and the remaining 30% was broken down. At the end of the same day, Radio Japan announced that all living creatures in Hiroshima had been burned and turned to ashes. The explosion killed 70,000 people, and another 70,000 people were seriously injured. By the end of the same year, the number of victims reached 166,000 due to radioactive effects. By 1950, this number reached 200,000, and the President of the United States announced the use of a new weapon in a statement and said, "We may be grateful to Providence that the German atomic bomb project had failed and that the United States and its allies had spent $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history and won." Truman then warned Japan, "If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth." Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware.
"Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth."
These words had the tone of the Jewish Bible, where it explains about the calamity and destruction of rebellious tribes. America planned to carry out a second nuclear attack on Japan on August 11th, and this time they chose a plutonium-239 bomb, but the attack was carried out 2 days earlier due to climatic conditions. August 9, 1945, another B-29 bomber flew to attack the city of Kokura. But the climatic conditions over Kokura were not suitable. The pilot reported that the sky was 70% cloudy and the city was not visible at all. The B-29 bomber circled the city three times to find a suitable opportunity to drop the bomb, but it was cloudy and the B-29 bomber was running out of fuel. Finally, they decided to head toward Nagasaki. Based on the amount of fuel remaining and the climatic conditions, they decided that if Nagasaki was cloudy, they would go to Okinawa on the way back and drop the bomb in the ocean. The B-29 bomber reached Nagasaki at 11 a.m. and it was cloudy as well. The pilot decided to return, but he noticed that the target at 11:01 a.m. when part of the clouds moved away. The people of the city were about to be saved, but they had to host the Fat Man. Seconds after the release of the bomb, heat equal to 3,900 degrees Celsius was released with a strong wind of 1,000 kilometers per hour. The explosion left 75,000 people dead. The Japanese creation myth was now reversed. First, it was matter, then the cloud, then light, and finally chaos and disorder. The formidable energy of the mythological gods destroyed nature. The same day Harry S. Truman went on, "I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government. We thank God that it has come to us instead of our enemies, and we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes."
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies, and we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
On August 15, 1945, Japanese Emperor Hirohito, in a declaration addressed to the Japanese people, "The enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage is indeed incalculable, taking the toll of many innocent lives. Should we continue to fight, not only would it result in an ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation, but also it would lead to the total extinction of human civilization. Such being the case, how are we to save the millions of our subjects or to atone ourselves before the hallowed spirits of our imperial ancestors? This is the reason why we have ordered the acceptance of the provisions of the Joint Declaration." This means the Japanese surrendered. General Douglas MacArthur triumphantly entered Japan. Now the world was at the disposal of the conquerors of the war to create a new system.
Restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always.
The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears.
Oppenheimer was later removed from his position, and politicians turned their backs on him. Although after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Oppenheimer received a Medal for Merit from President Harry S. Truman, and France made him an officer of the Legion of Honor, but he never returned to his position. In 1965, Oppenheimer was diagnosed with throat cancer. He fell into a coma for 2 years and died at the age of 62. He once appeared in front of a camera and said with a hesitant face, "We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent." I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
That he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in the month of November. However, what Israelis cannot sabotage is the spirit of resistance among Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept noted, for 3 weeks this fall, Israeli regime forces closed all roads leading in and out of Nablus, a Palestinian city of 170,000 people and the economic hub of the occupied northern West Bank. As residents of the city and surrounding villages were locked in or out, cut off from jobs, school, family, and access to medical care, Israeli regime troops entered the city with armored vehicles, placed snipers on rooftops, shot at homes, and reportedly blocked medical crews from aiding the wounded. At least 6 people were killed and dozens were injured during the siege, which a prominent Palestinian human rights group denounced as a form of collective punishment. While the Zionist regime partially lifted the road closures earlier this month, the 21-day lockdown signaled a remarkable escalation of Israeli regime forces in a part of the West Bank that is, at least nominally, under the control of the Palestinian Authority. But the incursions and blockade of Nablus were only the latest in a growing series of Israeli regime acts of aggression in the West Bank that have put Palestinians on edge even before an Israeli regime escalation returned right-wing former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to power this month. while the territory, home to nearly 3 million people, has been under military occupation since 1967, and violence by the Zionist regime troops and settlers is relatively commonplace, the last few months have reminded residents of past surges in Israeli regime violence that were met with widespread Palestinian resistance, including during the Second Intifada of the early 2000s. You don't see the West Bank in the news like you see in Gaza. Because Gaza is bombed, you have these devastating images, videos, stories. It gets in the news, but even then, it dissipates. Yara Asi, a Palestinian-American researcher who was working in Nablus through the recent siege, told The Intercept, adding, "I think what obscures a situation that has been getting significantly worse in the West Bank. This is firmly within Area A, as designated by Oslo Accords," she added, referring to a breakdown of the occupied territories in different areas of control, with Area A being one theoretically under the civil and security control of the Palestinian Authority, adding, "So when you hear that Israeli regime jeeps have raided the city or that they have closed the city, this just belies the whole artifice that Oslo ever was, which is that there is any place of Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank." The United Nations last month warned of an explosive situation as 2022 is on track to become the deadliest year in the West Bank since 2026, with at least 105 Palestinians, including 26 children, killed there, a 57% increase over the last year. The youngest 7-year-old Rayan Soleiman died of an apparent cardiac arrest after being chased by Israeli regime troops near the city of Beit Lahm. 10 Israeli citizens, 3 foreigners, and 4 Israeli troops were killed by Palestinians from the West Bank in that time frame, according to the UN. But deaths are only one way to measure the worsening situation in the West Bank, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians also face restricted mobility, land expropriation, and economic hardships created by the occupation forces. Movement restrictions by way of the Zionist regime checkpoints and road closures in particular have been tightening, while attacks by settlers, often operating with the military's protection, have become more frequent. The olive harvesting season, when Palestinian farmers leave their villages to work in the groves, have become one of the most dangerous for them. Still, the almost routine reality of the violence Palestinians face has made it hard for observers to grasp at the big picture and take note of a perceptible shift that is further fueling anxiety and resentment. Only when you step back, you see just how alarming it is, how devastating this whole thing is, said Bhutto, stressing that violence is a built-in feature to the occupation. "I am torn between saying this is an escalation and saying this is part of what we have lived through for 55 years. The whole world is shocked by other countries, but that shock doesn't apply here in the West Bank because it's been 55 years. Uncertainty in the West Bank has been thrown into further turmoil by the result of the Zionist regime's 50th election in 4 years earlier this month, which returned Netanyahu to power and is set to give the fabricated regime of Israel its most right-wing government ever. Some Palestinians note that what happens in Israeli regime politics doesn't change the reality of the occupation. They point to the Zionist regime violence over the last year as an effort by the former government to prove that it was as tough as the right-wing opposition. If anything, they add, Netanyahu's extremism exposes the reality of the Zionist regime's plans for continued expansion in the West Bank. It's too soon to predict whether the shift will last and how effective a new generation of Palestinian resistance groups can be. The fabricated regime of Israel's crackdown in recent months has led to the killing or arrest of much of the group's leadership, though support for them appears to be growing. Also, in response to that crackdown, the dynamic is now new. While some form of armed resistance has remained a constant throughout the occupation, there have been surges in Palestinians' efforts to directly confront the Zionist regime forces, and they have been promptly met with Israeli regime repression. Every so many years, you see a willingness to re-engage with a broader armed resistance, which I think is shaped in part by a distance from the severe repression that the Israeli regime brings on Palestinians every time these uprisings begin to form, said Munayir, a Palestinian activist. Whether mounting Israeli regime violence across the West Bank or over the last several months will plunge the territory back into the larger-scale fighting of the past remains in question, but it's a question Palestinians and others are increasingly voicing, with some referring to it as a simmering intifada, a big resistance. Munayir said, I can't tell you how many times I have heard people say the next intifada has started, but I think what we are seeing reflects the overwhelming